So let's begin in Psalm 69, and we're going to read for now verses 1 through 4 of Psalm 69. 69, 1 through 4. Save me, O God, for the waters have threatened my life. I have sunk in deep mire, and there is no foothold. I have come into deep waters, and a flood overflows me. I'm weary with crying. My throat is parched. My eyes fail while I wait for my God. Those who hate me without a cause are more than the hairs of my head. Those who would destroy me are powerful. What I did not steal, I then have to restore. So a couple of things to note here for the first four verses is this is very similar to what we looked at last week in Psalm 22. Psalm 22 was written from the perspective of somebody who faced immense suffering and persecution. And that then becomes a foreshadowing of the suffering and persecution of Jesus. The writer of Psalm 69, who we believe to be David, who also wrote Psalm 22, is facing that same kind of persecution. Perhaps David wrote this in the same period of his life as Psalm 22, though I would not contend one way or another on that, because certainly there are several different points in David's life where he really could have looked at the adversaries around him and written a psalm like 22 or 69 or some of the others. Even from his youth, he faced great persecution at the hands of Saul. When he was king, he faced persecution as well. Later on in life, because of the rebellion of Absalom, he faced rejection and had to actually leave Jerusalem and leave behind some of his own people in the city of Jerusalem. And Absalom abused those people. And in his flight from Absalom, his own son, he certainly could have written something like Psalm 69. So there are a lot of different points in his life where David could have written this. And so I do see that there as being a very similar thing to Psalm 22. What do you think here? What do you think about these first couple verses and this kind of repeated references to water and the deep and things overflowing and flooding over me and being overwhelmed by that? What do you think of that symbolism? There you go. Revelation. Several times we've pointed out in our class in the book of Revelation, several times we've pointed out that it was a very typical thing in Hebrew poetry to look at the ocean and the sea and the great waters, those different kinds of pictures, as fear. That's what they're you're to be afraid of those things. And it was very typical in Hebrew poetry because, remember, the Israelites were not a seagoing people. And I pointed this out before, but for the sake of anybody who might be watching online or anything like that later on, it's worth pointing out again that if you look at their history and water, even in the Old Testament, the Israelites did not exactly have a healthy relationship with water. It takes miracles by God to get them across water. The Red Sea had to be parted so they could escape from Egypt. The Jordan River had to be parted so they could cross the Jordan and get to the land of Canaan and enter the Promised Land. Water was something they were afraid of. And in their literature and in their poetry and in their symbolism, the ocean and the deep tended to represent the thing they feared most. If you could pick out one of their greatest fears, the phobia of the Israelites as a collection of people, fear of water would probably be one of the things that would be on the list there of a collective phobia. So here in verses 1 and 2, he's going back to that symbolism. The deep, I'm overwhelmed. It's water that's overtaking me right now. Drowning, being in the deep, being overwhelmed. That's a really striking, isn't it? Now, I don't like water either. I don't know. Maybe I come from a long line of Israelites or something because I'm not crazy about water either. I don't like extreme water sports, as the young people call them these days. If I'm going to be on the water, it's going to be on a big ship with a buffet. That's all I'm interested in. I tried snorkeling one time and I saw a pufferfish and panicked. Rebecca never lets me forget about that. She said, it was so cute. No, he turned to charge at me. Okay, that pufferfish. If that pufferfish accidentally went into my mouth, he would poison me. That pufferfish meat is poisonous, you know. I don't like the ocean. And so I can kind of understand, I can sympathize here with the idea of being kind of pulled underwater and being hopeless and seeing life and breath and sunlight disappearing above your head as you're sinking deep down. You're losing touch with life is what it is. And that's what it feels like for him to be overwhelmed by his suffering at this time. Now, I suppose it takes maybe a little bit of imagination to put Jesus in this scene as well. But if you were to pick out a particular scene in Jesus' life where he was overwhelmed to a degree, what do you think that would be? Okay, on the cross for sure. On the cross for sure. And there's other aspects of Psalm 69, like verses 20 and 21, for example, that do give us an indication that this is a messianic prophecy that's pointing to the cross. Some of the other things, the gall for food, for example, happened at the foot of the cross. That was a scene during his crucifixion. And so it is not unreasonable for us to imagine this same feeling of being overwhelmed, of being flooded, of being overtaken, my crying, my eyes failing me. It's not a stretch for us to see this in Jesus on the cross. I could also say Jesus in the garden the night before. Certainly the overwhelming nature of the emotional and spiritual burden that he carried that night was something that none of us has ever or will ever experience. I do feel like, and I think I've said this to you before, I feel like that prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane was probably the most intense emotional experience in human history. That was the human body being pushed to the limit as far as the feelings of God, the feelings and the emotions of God coursing through a small human body. That body of his was probably to the breaking point because of the intensity of his emotions that night. So, I can see both the cross and the events leading up to the cross as kind of encompassing that. Let's look specifically at verse 4, because I do think there's more of a prophecy here in verse 4 that is definitely worth our time. Those who hate me without cause are more than the hairs of my head. Those who would destroy me are powerful. What I did not steal, I then have to restore. And I really like that phrase in particular. What I did not steal, I then have to restore. To me, that encompasses the mission of Jesus, isn't it? What I didn't steal, I'm now restoring. The sins that I didn't commit, I'm now paying for. The debt that I did not accrue, I'm now making up for it. What I didn't steal, I'm restoring in the process of the cross. Now, I can see in the context that this is David speaking. I totally understand that. And David is definitely not paying a debt in his life that we owe. But to understand what it feels like to be punished for crimes you didn't commit, to be harmed and harangued and persecuted for nothing. What did David do to Saul? Yeah, silence. Nothing. Nothing. And Jonathan, Saul's son, even goes out of his way to point out, Dad, you need to understand, David has been nothing but good to you. David has always supported you. He has always helped you, and he always will help you. And you're trying to kill a man who's been there for you. And Saul wouldn't even listen to that. David did nothing. There was no reason why Saul should have been actually threatened. Now, he imagined a threat there, but there's no reason that Saul should have actually been threatened by David. There's no reason why David should have been chased around like a common criminal, hiding and living in caves, barely scraping by an existence. There's no reason, nothing David did that was evil where he deserved that treatment. Lance?
I've never associated these two things together before, but the idea of doing good to someone, heaping coals upon them, mm-hmm. is kind of what David did to Saul. So what did David do to Saul? Just got to his goad because he did nothing really wrong against him.
Yeah, that's a good point. I like that. Yeah, bringing in that Romans chapter 12 language there, heaping burning coals upon his head. That's kind of what he did. Everything David did was for Saul and for the kingdom of Saul to support him, and yet all of it just annoyed Saul, threatened him, aggravated him, frustrated him, enraged him even. And yet everything David did was for the glory of both Saul and the kingdom of Israel. And the glory of God, of course, I don't discount that. I'm just saying that everything he did had some relation to being a servant to Saul. Even at different points where David refused to kill Saul, he had Saul in his sights twice, both in the cave when Saul was relieving himself and in the camp when Saul was sleeping at night and David took the spear from his side. Twice David could have killed him and didn't, because why?
It's God's anointed.
You are God's anointed. I could not lift my hand against God's anointed. Now, I do think this is Jesus as well. And the language again there, which I really like there, just this idea of paying back something you did not steal, reminds me of Isaiah 53. And we're going to go to Isaiah 53 a couple times in our conversation today. So if you've got an extra bookmarker, you'd probably throw it in Isaiah 53 for some comparison there. In Isaiah 53 and verse 6, all of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, but the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. Again, the idea of paying for something that he did not owe, having to restore something that he didn't steal. But a lot of it goes back to what we talked about this morning in our morning lesson, that God is a perfect God who demands justice. He cannot tolerate sin in his presence. He cannot even look upon sin. Back at 1 verse 13. He can't even tolerate it. It can't be Psalm 5 verse 4. It can't even be in his presence. Something has to pay for sin. Something has to pay the penalty in order for the gap to be bridged, for us to have a relationship with God, to be in his presence, to commune with him. Something has to pay for the sin to atone us. And it had to be Jesus. He had to pay what we could not have paid ourselves. Brian?
Well, that verse is interesting too, because it's not just the enemies that are against Jesus. Not to say that God would be against Jesus, but it's also in that verse, it's God who's laying those things on Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, it pleased the Lord to bruise him. It was God's will that these things were done. So it was the will of the enemies of Jesus, but it, you know, by extension, was also the will of God to do that same thing. So while the enemies of Jesus had negative intentions against Jesus, God had the same outcome in mind, but a positive intention that Jesus would save all of those people from their sins.
Yeah, and as a side note, it's just another example of the way that we sometimes think we're doing what we want to in this life when we're actually just fulfilling God's will. The Romans thought they were dealing with a pest. The Jewish leadership, the high priests and the Pharisees, thought they were eliminating competition. All of them probably wiped the sweat from their brows and took a deep breath and said, "Phew, glad we took care of that Jesus character. Whew, okay, fine. Glad we're done with him. Glad that Jesus, that Nazarene stuff is in the past and we don't have to deal with that anymore." By doing their own will, they were actually accomplishing God's will. Yeah, that's a good point, Brian. I like that. Yeah, the Lord was pleased to bruise him. The Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to follow him. The Lord caused it. The Lord wanted it to happen. The Lord made it happen. That was not an accident. It was not an afterthought. It wasn't a plan B. He caused it to happen. So there's a discussion question on the second page of your material in this chapter. And that question is, what other New Testament passages help us understand the way that Jesus bore our sins or paid the price for our redemption? What other language, what other New Testament passages can you see that sort of just confirm this idea from Psalm 69? Maybe while you're pulling up any that you had thought of, one that I thought of was from 1 Peter, a passage that I actually didn't get a chance to read this morning, just for the sake of time. But in 1 Peter chapter 2, look at verse 21. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21. "For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth." That's a quote from Jeremiah 11, verse 20, by the way. And again, that's what we're looking at there, is he didn't commit sin. It wasn't his sin that he was paying for. It wasn't for anything he did that he died. He was paying back something that he didn't actually steal. "And while being reviled," in verse 23, "he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously." And in verse 24, "And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed." Isaiah 53 and verse 5 also notes that. By his wounds you were healed. It's by his stripes that we're healed. What does it mean by stripes there in Isaiah 53? Lashes, yeah. The wounds on the back from one who has been lashed by a whip or cords. It's by His stripes that we're made whole. By His wounds, we are healed. It's by His punishment that we are made righteous. So anyway, that's one that I had thought of. Any other passages that come to my that come to your mind, just off the top of your head?
Hebrews 2, verses 17 and 18.
All right, let's pull that one up. Hebrews chapter 2, verses 17 and 18. Thanks, Mitch. Therefore, He had to be made like His brethren in all things that He might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. And that's not the only time we've seen the word propitiation before also. For since He Himself was tested or tempted in that which He suffered, He's able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. He suffered so that we could have aid. He died to make propitiation for whose sins? Our sins. Yeah, because of our sins. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. I like that one, Mitch. There's several others, of course, that we could look at. If there's nothing off the top of your head that you wanted to point out, one more that maybe I had thought of. I want to check it real quick here. In Colossians chapter 2, in Colossians chapter 2, of course, the whole chapter of Colossians 2 is really quite good. But in Colossians 2, notice in verse 11, "And in Him you were also circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, in the removal of the body of flesh by the circumcision of Christ, having been buried with Him in baptism, in which you are also raised up with Him through faith in the working of God, who raised Him from the dead. And when you were dead in your transgressions and the uncircumcision of your flesh, He made you alive together with Him, having forgiven us all of our transgressions, having canceled out the certificate of debt consisting of decrees against us and which was hostile to us, and He has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross." The debt that we had, the decrees that were against us, the sins that we committed, when we were dead in our transgressions and trespasses, He made up the difference. He made up the difference. It was a debt that we could not have paid. Understand that. Understand it was a debt that we could not have paid. All right, let's look at another idea here. Any comments up to this point in the psalm? Anything you wanted to point out? Okay, let's keep reading then. Can I get a volunteer now? I want to read just the next whole section and then point out specifically verses 8 and 9 I think are worth us worth some conversation. But if somebody wants to read with the mic verses 5 through 12, just read the whole next section. Dennis has it. Okay. Dennis, just read Psalm 69, 5 through 12.
O God, it is You who knows my folly, and my wrongs are not hidden from You. May those who wait for You not be ashamed through me, O God, O Lord God of hosts. May those who seek You not be dishonored through me, O God of Israel, because for Your sake I have borne reproach. Dishonor has covered my face. I have become estranged from my brothers and an alien to my mother's sons. For zeal for Your house has consumed me, and the reproaches of those who reproach You have fallen on me. When I wept in my soul with fasting, it became my reproach. When I made sackcloth my clothing, I became a byword to them. Those who sit in the gate talk about me, and I am the song of the drunkards.
So, you know, obviously verse 5 is something we've got to deal with here, because if this is a messianic prophecy, then how can we possibly be talking about Jesus having follies and wrongs that are not hidden from God? Two explanations that I see there for verse 5. The first one is, not everything is messianic. And to me, that's a reasonable explanation. It was true of Psalm 22. It's true of the book of Isaiah. Not everything in the book of Isaiah is messianic. There's a lot of it. Especially after chapter 40, right? From 40 onward, there's a lot of messianic stuff in Isaiah. But not everything in Isaiah is messianic. Not everything in Psalm 69 is messianic. Same with Psalm 110, Psalm 22. I mean, not everything is messianic. Different aspects of this apply to Jesus, and other aspects are applicable to David. So that's one explanation. But I think even the second explanation, let's just say the whole psalm is applicable to Jesus. Is there any concession that we have to make whatsoever for Jesus to say, God, you know my sins? How many sins did Jesus commit? None. Hebrews chapter 4. Or Hebrews chapter 2. He committed no sins. And so in a sense, it might not be, if you kind of take this as messianic rather than specifically Davidic, one way to look at it is, this is not a statement saying, oh God, I have lots of sins that you know about. This could almost be as a defense, like God is my witness about how many sins I've committed, that God will stand for me because God knows the sins I've committed. Did the Pharisees think Jesus committed sins? They sure did. They believed he was a Sabbath breaker. Did the chief priest believe that he was committing sins? Yeah, because he was blaspheming God and saying that he could tear the temple down and rebuild it in 3 days. Sure, they believed that Jesus committed sins. They accused him of sins. And so in a sense, if verse 5 is messianic, then it could almost be an appeal to God to say, you know what? You claim I commit sins. You claim I'm a Sabbath breaker. You claim I'm a blasphemer. You claim I'm crazy. God, though, God knows how many sins I've committed, and I'm beholden to him alone. So I think there's even an explanation there where you don't necessarily have to start picking and choosing what is messianic and what's not. You have to cut verses out or whatever from the interpretation. I don't know if you necessarily have to do that, at least in this particular case. Lance?
So we're not judged just by our sins. Mm-hmm. In fact, our sins are forgiven on Judgment Day. But I think about the parable of the talents, where I believe it's 5, 10, and 2. Mm-hmm. And the one that had two, you could argue that he sinned by not putting the money with the bankers. But he was accused of not working with the talents that he had. So yeah, it's not just you doing wrong, but it's also you serving God. Mm-hmm. And doing those things. And Jesus repeatedly said that he came to do the Father's will. Mm-hmm. He had a job to do, and he completed that job. And so you started to go there whenever you said, God witnessed the things that Jesus did.
Yeah.
And that's why Jesus was found pleasing to God, is because he did his will all the way up to the point of death, which we're talking about here.
Yeah. So it was as much about his obedience as anything else. So, and again, just to kind of sum that up, you know, where he's saying, you know my folly, my wrongs aren't hidden from thee. Like, God, you'll be my witness. You'll be my witness. You know what I've done in life. You know. And God knows that Jesus did not commit a sin in any of the things that he did. Just as God knows that Job did not commit a sin. It even goes out of his way in, I believe it's Job chapter 2, the writer goes out of his way to point out that in all of these things, in all of this, Job did not commit a sin. At least up to that point, in all those things, Job had not committed a sin. So, God knows. God knows those who are blameless, and God knows those who are full of blame. Go ahead, Dale.
He was being accused of sinning, though, and he was being accused of wrongs and foolishness and folly. So, the next verse he says, I hope those who are yours aren't ashamed of me.
Yeah.
You know what I'm all about, God, but I hope the other ones aren't ashamed of me.
Yeah.
And it might be more about the charges against him, even though they're false. Sometimes charges are brought against us and they're never refuted, and therefore people believe them.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want God's people to be ashamed of him over them. Hmm. Not to say he had sins, just to say that he's being accused of them.
Yeah.
And God knows better, but the other people don't.
Yeah, and that prayer in verse 6, this prayer, so to speak, is, you know, let no damage be done to the work because of me. What a sad thing, too, isn't that? What a sad thing that we could read this and it has these messianic undertones or overtones, excuse me. And we can read in verse 6 that here is in a sense, Jesus saying, don't let people be ashamed because of me. Don't let people be ashamed of you or think wrongly of you or come to a wrong impression of you because of me. And we might read that, we'd be so shocked by it, like, Jesus is the hero. Jesus is the hero in this story. But he was such a tender-hearted person, someone who cared so much about God and obeying his will, that to think that anybody could lose faith in God or think ill of God over his example, over his predicament, just shows, I think, his incredible tenderness and obedience. Brian?
It's kind of hard not to think about Paul throughout all of this, too. I mean, yeah. Obviously this is, you know, in reference to Jesus and holds a specific meaning toward him, but, you know, in a lot of this, you kind of, this same language in verse 6, you can almost hear Paul saying this. Mm-hmm. You know, and in a few places he did pretty much say, you know, I hope my chains are not a reason for anyone else to lose heart, but in fact to glorify God instead of
Philippians chapter 1, right? For example.
And so it's just sort of that same kind of, you could almost see Paul going back here and looking at this, and when Paul was modeling his life after Christ, you know, again, just the same kind of language over and over again.
You could sum it up by saying it's the servant spirit. David was a servant of God who wanted God to be glorified. Paul was a servant of God who wanted God to be glorified. And Jesus, even the Son, was a servant of God who wanted God to be glorified. I don't care what happens to me. It's not about me. It's about God and the furthering of His kingdom and His work. Good point. I like these are good comments. Verse 7, though. Because for thy sake I have borne reproach. Dishonor has covered my face. For thy sake I've borne reproach. This is a good point, and I point this out in the Sermon on the Mount also. Whenever I study the Sermon on the Mount with people, and you're looking at the Beatitudes, and in Matthew chapter 5, when Jesus is talking about the Beatitudes, in verses 10 through 12, he talks about, blessed are you when you've been persecuted. Is it just persecution at all? Just any kind of persecution? Or is it persecution for righteousness' sake? Yeah, when you're persecuted for righteousness' sake, when you're persecuted for my name's sake, When people say all kinds of, verse 11, when people say evil against you falsely on account of me, all right, that's to me it's similar language. And I always point out when I teach the Sermon on the Mount, persecution is itself not a sign of honor. It's not any kind of credit to you to just be persecuted. There's all kinds of people who are persecuted. And you know, some people are persecuted because of things they bring on themselves. And some people are persecuted because of their own sins. And some people are persecuted and they deserve to be persecuted. So persecution itself is not a virtue to say, oh, blessed am I because I'm persecuted. No, there's got to be a why behind it. There has to be a why. And that to me, verse 7, is the why. Because for thy sake I've borne reproach. Dishonor has covered my face. It's not just because I'm bearing reproach. There's lots of people who bear reproach who don't bear it for any kind of virtuous reason. But if you're bearing reproach for the sake of God, did David's integrity stand with him as he wrote Psalm 69? Did Job's integrity stand with him when he was arguing with his three friends? Did Jesus' integrity stand with him even as he remained silent before his false accusers in that sham of a court proceeding? Yeah, their integrity stood with them because they knew why they were suffering. They were suffering for something bigger. They weren't suffering for money. They weren't suffering for land. They weren't suffering for an earthly king or his glory. They were suffering for God's sake. And they knew that. And their integrity stood with them. Verse 8, I've become estranged from my brothers and an alien to my mother's sons. Did this actually happen with David? Yes. Did this actually happen with Jesus? I love these cross-testamental connections that we're making. That might be a made-up term, but I like it. Cross-testamental connections. At what point did David feel like he was estranged from his brothers or alienated from his brothers? Okay, when he was in a pit. Yeah, that'd be one place. Yeah, estranged. How about when he was even really young? Remember after he was chosen by Samuel? By God through Samuel, that is. In 1 Samuel chapter 16, remember when he was chosen above his older, stronger, burlier, older brothers? What do you think they thought of that? Yeah, just a kid. They probably weren't crazy about that. And you kind of see, even though chapter 16 of 1 Samuel does not have any kind of indication or a look into the brothers' lives, when you look in chapter 17, and when David comes to the battlefield against the Philistines to observe the battlefield and interact with his brothers there and bring them provisions. What was his brother's attitude?
You come just to see the show.
Yeah, you're a kid and you want to come see the show. That's all you care about. You're just a kid and you just want to come see some people kill each other. That's all you're interested in. You just coming to see a show. So, and I know it's a stretch for us to say, he had several brothers. And this is only one of his brothers in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 28. There's only one of his brothers there saying that. I get that. But if that's any indication of what the other brothers must have thought about David, then David did not hold, then David was not held in really high regard by his brothers. He was the little brother. He was ruddy. Okay, he's a handsome little ruddy boy. Okay, not highly regarded by his brothers. And to top it all off, the prophet of God comes to him and says that he gets to be king after Saul. That does not fit their preconceptions or their expectations. And so there were several points where David probably felt like he did not have a place amongst his own brothers. Bruce?
And it goes past his brothers too, because later on, when his son was trying to replace him as king and trying to kill him, basically, though his entire family was up against him, not just his brothers.
Yeah, and they had to pick sides. You know, they had to pick sides. David left a lot of people behind when he fled from Jerusalem that night. He left a lot of people behind. And that was just the nature of the situation, wasn't it? He probably felt very isolated. He was able to bring only a few people. He had to leave behind his harem. And we all know that Absalom devastatingly abused that harem in a very disgusting and public way. He left a lot of people behind and probably felt very isolated, very lonely when he was in the wilderness hiding from Absalom. What a difficult time for him. What about Jesus, though? What did Jesus' brothers think of him? Yeah, not at first, at least. Not if you take the Gospel of John very seriously. In John chapter 7 and verse 5, it says that not even his own brothers were believing. They were actually mocking him. They were saying, when are you going to go up to Jerusalem and show yourself off? Hey, if you're a real prophet, why don't you go to the big city? Go to the capital city and show yourself off a little bit. And of course, Jesus' response was, this is not the right time for me to be going there. And it's after that where it says that not even his own brothers were believing in him. Yeah. Yeah. Extend out from just his immediate family and see that the idea of brethren rather than just brothers, of his brothers by nationality, they were the very people who rejected him. You read Peter's sermon in Acts chapter 2, and that's the whole point of it. I mean, the whole build-up in Acts chapter 2 is to get to the point of, and this Jesus who you crucified... You crucified your own Messiah. You crucified the very person you've been waiting for all this time. And that was the whole point of that sermon on the day of Pentecost, was to get to that point that you rejected him. You rejected him and you crucified him. So there's an alienation there. Whether it's Jesus' actual brothers, whether it's his brethren in nationality, whether it's David and his actual brothers, or the isolation when he ran away from Absalom. In any case, the writer of Psalm 69 feels isolated and alienated. And yet, even with the isolation, what's on his mind in verse 9? He's alone, he's rejected, he's forlorn and outcast, paying a debt that he didn't owe, and yet what is on his mind in verse 9? Zeal for thy house has consumed me. He cares about God, the presence of God, worshiping God, the sanctuary of God, zeal for thy house has consumed me, and the reproaches of those who reproach thee have fallen on me. They hate you, God. They want to abuse you or mistreat you. I'm getting the same thing now. We're receiving the same treatment together. I'm lumped together now with God and the prophets and all the people who have served you and loved you and been for you and have been reproached because of it. We're together now in God's house. I like that there's a unity there. We're together now in God's house is maybe one way to look at it. What do you think of this idea? Brian, go ahead.
I was just going to say that was the passage that they remembered in John chapter 2, verse 17, after Jesus cleans out the temple and, you know, makes a whip and goes in there and drives all these people out doing business. Then his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house has eaten me up.
Yeah.
It's sort of this, you know, they remember that this occurred, and they're pointing right back to this psalm. So even people not Jesus himself are realizing the connection here.
And I like that they're not dullards when it comes to the scriptures. We kind of assume because we have these convenient Bibles and we have a Bible on our tablet or our phone, and we can cross-reference and look here and there and look up a verse on Google if we can't remember where it is. And we just assume that we just kind of have the market cornered in human history on Bible knowledge. And yet, you know, these people, they observed Jesus. His disciples observed Jesus. And sometimes it was in hindsight that they only realized it. But even in hindsight, they were able to go back and see, you know, Psalm 69? Yes, Psalm 69 was about Jesus. That was about Jesus. We just lived for 3.5 years in a ministry with Psalm 69 living, embodied, active, right before our eyes. Dale, go ahead.
Yeah, it doesn't just imply that he remembered the zeal for the house of God. He says, for zeal for your house.
Yeah.
And it seems like what he's saying here is, I'm being persecuted and accused and being pushed away from my brethren because I have zeal for your house.
Yeah.
That's the very reason he's in this predicament in the first place.
That's a good point. I like that. And to me, there's a connection there. There's a connection to Psalm 84, okay? And Psalm 84 is of the sons of Korah. It's not necessarily something that David wrote. But if you compare Psalm 84 to this, for zeal for the house has consumed me, boy, you get those first few verses there. Does the writer of Psalm 84 have zeal for the house of God as well? Oh, yeah, he sure does. How lovely are thy dwelling places. My soul longed for and even yearned for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh sing for joy to the living God. How blessed are those who dwell in thy house, in verse 4, for they are ever praising thee. But he does mention in verses 8 through 12 that there are evil people as well. Behold our shield, O God. Look upon the face of thine anointed. You need to look upon me. I need a shield. I need protection from other people. And I would rather be in your household, he says in verse 10, than dwell in the house, than dwell in the tents of the wicked. So were the wicked there? Yeah, the wicked were there. Did he need a shield? He needed a shield as well. Zeal for thy house. What a great theme that is. Zeal for thy house. Zeal for thy house consumed David as well. I love some stories here. These are all in the notes here in some passages here. But in 2 Samuel chapter 6, David helps set up the tabernacle in Jerusalem and brings the Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem. In what way did zeal for thy house manifest itself in that particular story for David? Dancing in the streets. I mean, he was dancing in the streets wearing commoner's clothes, to the point that his wife Michal, Saul's daughter, was ashamed of him. I cannot believe, you're not acting like a king. That's not something a king would do. And it's like, hey, you know what? When I'm happy for God, I'm happy for God. And I don't have to be judged by anybody but him. So that's zeal for thy house. He's jumping around in the streets because the ark of God is back and he set up the tabernacle. It does point that out in verses 17, 18, and 19 that he set up the tabernacle for it, which would have been the house of God, at least in his eyes, until he was able to build a temple, which in chapter 7, 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 2, building a temple was the next thing he wanted to do. I live in this beautiful palace, but where does the ark of God live? Where does your presence dwell? It dwells in a shambly tent over there. I want to build a house for your name. So when God tells him he can't build a house, how does zeal manifest itself even in the denial? Did David go, well, I guess I can't build a house for God. That's that. Yeah. He drew up plans. He gathered materials. He had warehouses full of stuff. And then he told his son Solomon. And that was the big thing. When you look at the speech between David and Solomon, of the last words of David to his son, what is the biggest thing on his mind? Solomon, you got to build a temple. You've got to build that temple. Build the temple. Build the temple. Build the temple. That is what's on his mind most of all, is I'm leaving you with material and plans and a goal and a dream and a vision to build a temple for God. You got to go do it now, Solomon. Zeal for his house consumed David. And I love this. This is awesome. Let's ask a discussion question, though, getting back to Jesus, okay? It's worth asking, isn't it? Because this is one of those things when you read in Matthew 21 or Mark chapter 11 or Luke chapter 19, when you read about Jesus, entering the courts of the temple and knocking tables over and hitting people with whips and telling them to get out, a lot of Bible skeptics and critics will look at that and go, wow, and that's the God who you worship? What a temper tantrum. Okay, was it a good thing for the zeal for thy house to consume Jesus in a way that led him to make a great big mess out of things and hit people with a whip? Was it justified? Yeah, Lance? I was just about to say something, but I'm going to let you go first.
So what would they have said if he followed through with the law when he caught the woman in adultery, or the woman was brought to him in adultery?
Yeah.
He would have been justified in being part of the crew that would have stoned her to death.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not why Jesus came. So I just... My point I just wanted to bring out is simple, is the fact that there's a lot of things that Jesus could have done, but it wasn't his time to judge the earth yet.
Mm-hmm.
He came for a different reason. I know.
Yeah.
Hopefully that leads into your comment.
No, and that's actually what I was going to do, is you have to ask, why did Jesus do this? Did Jesus do it just because it was corrupt and they were making money off of people? No, I don't think that's the main reason. Otherwise, Jesus would have spent all day, every day in Jerusalem, busting doors open of corrupt businesses and people with false scales and brothels. I mean, there's all kinds of... If it was just about corrupt business practices, if that was the main thing of, dude, you guys are making money off of people coming to the temple, that's not the main thing. I think the main point was the holiness of God. In whatever age, in whatever covenant, from the patriarchs to the old law, in the temple, in the sacrificial system, to the new covenant, in the way that we worship God, it is about God's holiness and respecting the integrity of God. However God asks mankind to respect that integrity in whatever covenant that person's living under in human history, to respect God's holiness is essential. It's essential. And in that covenant, where Jesus was living under the law in a time when the temple was in place and there was a priesthood by the order of Aaron, sacrifices were being offered, that service then was what God asked of them in that covenant. And so it's not just a violation of integrity. It's not just a violation of good business practices. It's not just greed. It's not just money. It's the fact that what they were doing was a desecration of the holiness of God. The temple was to be a holy place where holy things happened, where holy attitudes were brought in. And those things were not happening. And this place that was supposed to be God's house had become a place of thieves. A den, he says, of thieves. Brian?
And Jesus wasn't trying to win a popularity contest either. I mean, he wasn't just trying to not rock the boat.
Yeah.
And so he would go in and do the things that needed to be done when they needed to be done.
Yeah.
He would stand up and call those Pharisees hypocrites
right
to their face. And that, in large part, that's what led him to become their enemies, was because he was telling them what they needed to hear, but they didn't want to hear it because of their own hardness of heart. And that's sort of the same thing here, when Jesus never did anything wrong, but he would still stand up there and look over Jerusalem and weep over Jerusalem, having wanted them to repent, but knowing that they wouldn't.
Yeah.
He was willing to do God's work and be reproached for it, and that was okay.
He was willing to do God's work and to be reproached for it, and that was okay. That's what Dale said. And that's a good point. I like that. That's a good point. Both of those points put together, I think, give us this idea of that God's main purpose in this world is to reveal himself as he sees fit. Our main purpose in this world is to respect that revelation of God. If God asks for a temple to be built, then there needs to be a reverence that comes with that. If God asks us to sing with our voices, there needs to be a reverence that comes with that. Everything that we do in this age, everything that was done in previous ages, in previous times where God had revealed himself through the prophets and through priests. In other times where God asks for animal sacrifices to be done. However God reveals himself in whatever age, that is to be respected and honored. It's good points. I like this. Really, really good points. And you know, it's for Jesus, it's a no-win. I like the, here you pointed out, Brian, earlier about the point that was made that, oh, it was Lance actually talking about the woman caught in adultery in John 9. I mean, it's a lose-lose. I mean, if he agrees with them, then they say, what a cruel man. Look at him. He's trying to stone people to death. If he doesn't agree with them, what a horrible man. Look at him. He's letting evildoers get away with it. I mean, there's no win.
Actually, he did win.
Yeah, actually,
his response was a win.
Yeah, his response sent them all away sheepishly. Yes, that is true. That is true. But that their goal was to get him into a lose-lose. And the same thing happens with the money changers. Let's say he leaves the money changers alone. Let's say he does nothing. People are going to stand by and watch and go, wow, he's allowing all this corruption to go on. He's just sitting here idly by. This same Jesus who said he'd tear the temple down and build it up in 3 days. But he's not even going to make any. He's not going to send the money changers away. I mean, it's a lose-lose for him, at least in their eyes. So he does what's right. And like Dale said, he does the work of God regardless of the reproach that comes upon him for it. If he's reproached for doing the work of God, who cares? It's not a popularity contest. He's not there to politic. He's not there to rub elbows. He's not there to be buddy-buddy and make friends with people. If he's there to do the work of God, that's going to come with some reproach sometime. So he'll knock the tables over, and he'll call the Pharisees hypocrites. And he'll touch the people who are not allowed to be touched. And he'll go to the people's lives who were rejects and alienated from society. He'll go to the sinners. He'll talk to the tax collectors. He will do what needs to be done regardless of the outcome in a worldly sense. And this is all pointed out here. For the sake of time, let's skip on down now to verses 20 and 21. 20 and 21 here. Reproach has broken my heart. And I am so sick. I looked for sympathy, but there was none. And for comforters, but I found none. We'll hold off on 21 just for a second. So verse 20. Put ourselves there in the position of Jesus and understand in the garden, where were his disciples? Sleeping over in the corner. Jesus was having the most excruciating emotional, spiritual, and physical experience that a human being could ever and has ever had in history. And his disciples were sleeping. I looked for comforters, but there was nobody there. On the cross, the same way. We pointed out last week that even though John and Jesus' mother Mary must have at least been within earshot, because he calls out to John and says, that's your mother now, take care of her. Just because John is within earshot does not mean he's right next to him comforting Jesus. It doesn't mean that he's at Jesus' feet telling him that it will be okay, wiping the sweat from his face, helping him breathe. I mean, John was within earshot, but that doesn't mean he was right there with Jesus alongside him. Jesus bore that suffering by himself. Jesus bore that burden by himself. I found no comforters. I looked for sympathy and there was none. There was nothing there. Nothing there. Verse 20 is just, I mean, it's so heartbreaking, isn't it? To read that. And I'm a very, you know how I am, I'm a very emotional person. Sometimes things just get to me. I'll tell you, this is your little Ryan piece for the day. There's one thing that gets me welled up every time, okay? Without fail, it's like pushing a button on a machine, okay? What? Crumbs? Yeah, well, I... Every night I go to bed and go, why are they so messy? Eat over your plate. No, it's... Yeah, I know. Yeah, this morning's lesson, yeah. It's families being reunited with veterans. Oh, that gets me every time. Seriously, that gets me every time. I don't care if it's like a goofy bank commercial or something. And they've got stock footage of a family being reunited with a veteran. I see families reunited with veterans. You know, I see the family at the football game getting honored, and dad comes out of the chute and surprises all of them. And I'm like, it's so beautiful. I can't believe it. So you know I'm emotional, but I read verse 20, and to me, verse 20 and the theme surrounding it, verse 20 coupled with the experience of Jesus in the garden, the account of that in the Gospels, and Jesus suffering in the garden and saying that reproach has broken my heart and I am sick. I'm sick because of my sadness. I'm sick because of my loneliness. I feel my loneliness in my body. I can feel it manifesting itself as physical pain. That gets me every time too. Even more than families being reunited with veterans. Any comments here on verse 20 before we look at verse 21 and bring things to a close? Yeah, Dale's got a comment. And Bruce, go ahead.
I know this is about Jesus, but I can't help but think about David and how he was betrayed by his own son and by his entire family, really. This is a lot of what he's feeling at that time as well.
Yeah.
So it not only applies to Jesus, but also to David.
Yeah, just put yourself in their shoes. It's easy to read these words as mere poetry, but when you really start imagining, when you really start going into your mind's eye and picturing what it would be like to be just totally rejected, look at the person next to you. I mean, most of us, we have a spouse, we have kids, we have a best friend, we have coworkers who like us, we have other Christians. We've got 25 Christians in here, and we all care about each other, we all like each other. Imagine if everybody in this room, everybody, from the person you don't know very well to your own spouse and your own kids, just turn their backs on you in your moment of greatest need. And they just turn their backs on you. And then multiply that by a million. You've got Jesus in the garden. Dale, and then we'll look at verse 21 real quick.
Yeah, we said that Jesus was doing God's work and he was reproached for it, and that was okay. But I think here he's saying he was okay with it, but it still hurt him. It still bothered him. It still upset him. And it was still concerning to him that was happening to him. So you see more of the humanity of Christ here in that side of him. He wasn't just a robot who said, well, fine, I'll just, if you want to reproach me, reproach me. I just don't care. He cared a lot.
He cared a lot. And that's the thing, and I like the way you put that. He wasn't just kind of robotic. Jesus wasn't calloused. He wasn't just going like, okay, come on, chief priest, bring it on. Give me your worst shot. He really cared. He really, really cared about it. Verse 21, they also gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink. Gall was poison, bitterness. And that was actually, I was researching, it was actually a pretty typical custom for the Romans when they executed somebody on the cross. It was very typical for them to actually give gall because gall would have dulled your senses. They would have given you gall to just kind of like, you know, take some of the pain away and increase the process. It was a poison, so it was going to kill you, but it was also going to dull your senses. So if they wanted you to die a little faster, they give you the gall to speed things along. And they offer Jesus the gall in Matthew chapter 27, verse 34. It was mingled with the drink that was given to Jesus just before he was crucified. Before he was actually put up on the cross, they offered him the gall. He tasted it and refused to drink it. Why? Why would Jesus refuse to drink the gall that was offered to him? Yeah, Jesus wasn't going to die by poisoning. He was going to die because he was hanging from a tree. You know, the tree being representative of the cross itself. That was the prediction. That was the prophecy. There was a certain way that he needed to die. And to be crucified was how he needed to die. He was not going to be poisoned. I think there's also, in a sense, if this is going to be suffering for all the world's sin, and if it pleased the Father to bruise the Lamb, to bruise the Son, there's no, nothing accomplished by removing the sensation. Do you have as much respect for Jesus, a numb Jesus, as you do for a Jesus who actually bore the pain and accepted it for what it was? You know, to me, that's the cheapest, the easy, the lazy way out of it, is say, well, I'll die for you, but I don't want to feel any pain while I'm doing it. I mean, that's kind of the lazy way of going about that. And of course, it also points out, and for my thirst, they gave me vinegar to drink. And that was John chapter 19, verses 29 and 30. He says, I thirst, and they gave him a sponge soaked in vinegar or sour wine, which, I don't know, just kind of to me that adds to the insult, doesn't it? I mean, there's just nothing more insulting than soaking a sponge in some vinegar, putting it on the end of a stick, and rubbing it in a guy's face. Oh, you're thirsty? You're thirsty, huh? Well, here's a vinegar-soaked sponge. That'll make you feel a lot better. So it's interesting here how you have things, and what I like about Psalm 69 is, admittedly, some of the stuff we talked about today took some imagination. Not everything in Psalm 69 just screams off the page, messianic prophecy. Yeah, some of it took some imagination to see the connection from David to Jesus. But were there elements in Psalm 69 that were literally and specifically fulfilled in the cross? Yeah, and that's what I like about it. You want to have things that are a little bit more imaginative? Sure, God will give you that. You want something really concrete? You're desperate for a really concrete prophecy that says, hey, this stuff wasn't made up. This stuff wasn't scripted. This was real. I mean, he got offered gall before the cross. God offered wine on the cross. That literally came true. Literally. Specifically. Details. That's what I love about Psalm 69. Any final comments before we close? Okay, appreciate your comments. Thank you.